Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all our listeners. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mudiwa Gabaza, and for today, it is a Friday, which means we do get into the economics news of the week. Now, usually we get into it with some of the top economics minds of the country, economists and the like. But for today, we are switching gears a little bit because we have had many people on this platform talking about the digital economy and what its implications are going to be. And one of the top issues to come out this week is an attack that actually happened on Experian SA, which exposed some personal information of as many as about an estimated 24 million South Africans and almost 800,000 businesses. This is according to the South African Banking Risk Center, or SABRIC, which is a non-profit organization set up by a major lender to actually combat bank-related organized crime. And now, with such a big cyber attack having happened, it does lend to what type of an economy we're going to be having going forward and into the future. Digital banking is nothing new, but the pace of adoption has been accelerated by the COVID-19 pandemic. And we just thought it would be valuable for us to be having a conversation with someone who can help us to unpack some of these issues and what it means. So we are happy to have Dr. Christoph Nieuwoud, who is an FNB executive, to sort of lead us through this discussion. Dr. Christoph, how are you?
I'm anyway, yeah. Thanks. Nice being on the show.
No. Thank you so much for joining us. So I think, you know, just for the benefit of our listeners, those that have not received SMSs from the banks or have not been keeping up, what actually happened with this particular attack and some of the numbers that we've been given, the 24 million, the 800,000, are those sort of accurate?
Yes. So this is something that happened at Experian. So I'll basically share just our understanding of it. They shared this information on retail and commercial customers with a counterparty that they thought was legitimate. But this was actually somebody posing as a legitimate counterparty. And on the retail side, what was shared was contact information of customers only. So this is not bank data. It's not financial information either. It is just, for example, cell phone numbers, emails, addresses. So that's on the retail side. So, and that number is very big, the 24 million. That closely matches the credit active population. So that's about the data that, you know, it seems to us like that's the data that Experian had on individuals. On the juristic side, they're quoting a number of 800,000. The CEO mentioned a smaller number, 600,000. In terms of the analysis that we've done on the FNB side and the information that we're getting back from SABRIC, the number of businesses that had information that was compromised is significantly less than that, less than order of magnitude less than that. But that is it is a wider set of information. So it's not just contact information in terms of businesses. Now, you may ask, now, why is that? Why are we making such a big thing of this? Really, it is because this information can be used to commit crime. So the contact information can be used by criminals to pretend that they are you, and or they can basically send you smishing or vishing attacks and that actually solicit further information for you in order to launch an attack on you.
Just taking a step back before we get into some of the deeper implications, Experian itself, what is its relationship with an institution like FNB?
So Experian is one of the major credit bureaus. So we are under regulations. All banks, or all lenders, in fact, are obliged to provide information to the bureaus. But you'll find in practice there's a lot of other counterparties that also provide information to bureaus, such as telco players, insurance players, etc. Because what the bureaus play a role is if they're tracking people's indebtedness and also actually payment profiles, whether people are making payments. So that's typically the role of the bureau. Now, in terms of this, what's happened here, I guess some of this is not really related to that credit bureau intention at all. like the retail information was contact information that was shared. So that is information that, you know, we're presuming that the bureau is keeping this information for companies or other parties to be able to contact their customers and have the latest information on their contact details, etc. And that is this information specifically on the retail side, and that was shared by the bureau.
It certainly does sound like there are a number of, different parties. And I guess on the one hand, you know, one would just say, some contact information. And as you were now starting to tell us, that information could also be then used to commit identity fraud and that type of thing. What are some of the other broad implications that such an attack could have?
Yeah, well, look, I think the first thing is actually it also just generates, a bit of distrust that people have in terms of interacting digitally, etc. I do think, therefore, it's important for us to talk about this and to set the context of this. I think on this particular incident, at least on the retail information, like we said, it does not seem that it's any directly sensitive information. It is, of course, personal information. But not directly sensitive banking information. It would actually still be quite an undertaking for if this got into the hands of a syndicate to commit fraud with it. They would still have to use this properly. In this particular case, it does seem like the Anton pillar was affected, so the actual hard drives were impounded, etc. So it may well be that there is no crime that will result from this particular incident. I mean, that obviously we always say you plan for the worst, but you hope for the best. So in this case, it may actually turn out, we have not seen specific crimes that have been committed on this data. So the impact may be more reputational in the end than anything else.
And what type of steps have you sort of taken to let your customers actually know what's going on? I do understand that under the new POPI Act that there is some type of a responsibility to let data actors or customers just know when such a breach does happen, even if the impact might be minimal.
In respect of Experian itself, clearly it would have to comply with the regulations in terms of letting customers know. From the F&B side and from the banking association side, clearly, the banks have had a look to understand the customer bases that were impacted. This on the retail side, this number is pretty big. It's basically the credit active population, so it's actually a wide set. But the level of implications is relatively low for individual customers. So the only main points there is to just again highlight the general awareness around, for example, not sharing your login name, your password, not sharing OTPs that are sent to you, not to click on strange emails that are sent to you. That really is probably the extent of what is needed from a retail perspective from customers to ensure that they are safe. On the business side, like I mentioned again, it is actually a relatively small number of counterparties that is affected. And on the commercial side, like I mentioned before, it's a relatively small number of counterparties that are impacted. And the bank has put in specific countermeasures to make sure that they're monitoring any of these accounts for fraud and is communicating directly with the counterparties in effect. So, like I said, we plan for the worst, but we hope for the best in this case. We'll keep a lookout to see if there is any fraud emerging from this incident that we can trace back to specifically.
The more that we sort of chat about some of these things, it just does seem as if the list of cyber attacks or cybersecurity, concerns is likely to rise, sort of going forward. What type of efforts are you making to educate, I guess, because you've just given us some tips just now, but I can sort of estimate that there must be some burden on a company like yours to be engaging with your customers a lot more now as people, are adopting more and more of the app, more and more of, digital banking and the like, just letting them know that they need to be staying safe. A lot of people have the same password for everything. And it does seem to signal some type of a behavior change that needs to be led with some education.
Those are great points, and thanks for giving some additional tips for our listeners. Actually, it's ironic that on the digital side, we believe that our app is actually the safest way for customers to interact with us and to make payments. I mean, the truth is, it's actually very difficult for a criminal to actually breach the app security protocols. You would see, even if you are doing transactions on online banking, so with internet banking, we are using the app to actually send the secure OTP, to use the app to validate the transaction. So the digital security that is in place today is actually quite impressive. It is really around the areas that haven't migrated to that. So, for example, you may know that the banks are getting rid of checks. You know, checks are actually, you know, quite prone to fraud because people can just counterfeit the signature. So with online banking on websites, et cetera, you know, that's why one needs to have a backup to get, you know, either you have an OTP or in our case, you know, we're using the app to validate that. So digital can give you a high level of security if one is using it properly. And that's really where, I guess, the customer education comes into, is getting customers onto the right mechanisms, in this case, the app, and for them, you know, to use it very securely.
I think what you've just mentioned about some of the, because when we think about some of these information security risks, we always think about it within a digital context, sort of forgetting that even some of the more analog forms of, let's say, transacting are susceptible to a lot of mismanagement, a lot of fraud, and a lot of dodgy dealings. So with that in mind, I guess this one is just sort of as a matter of interest over your years in the industry, analog versus digital, right? How do you sort of balance the two in terms of the safety risks?
Absolutely. I think it's a brilliant point. In our case, actually, technology has proven to be a significant deterrent to crime. So in the same way that I mentioned that checks are quite prone to fraud. For example, in the old days, people used to have magstripe cards, you know, before there was chip and pin, before there was EMV on the cards. And that significantly increased the possibility, because the ability to actually clone a magstripe card is quite high, whereas a chip and pin card is actually virtually impossible to clone the chip. So, you know, where people would have committed crime on that is on the online space, really, is because what we call card not present fraud. Then, of course, we've introduced additional measures in there. So we are basically sending you a message to the app to confirm your online purchases. Another way to think about where a lot of crime has moved to is, for example, countries like the US have not actually pushed chip and PIN aggressively. So a lot of the crime, why syndicates would steal credit card numbers is so that they can commit crime in the US. Another thing to think about is, for example, if you are buying stuff online, you actually are not in the store, right? Do you know if the store will actually deliver it? And that's where, for example, using your credit card for online purchases actually gives you significant fraud protection, not just fraud protection. But if you were buying an airline ticket and the airline folded, you would be able to claim the money back, because those are the kind of rights that the banks will give you under your card issuing scheme. So those are the many considerations where technology can actually protect and increase the safety of a customer from getting defrauded. Think about walking around with a lot of cash. There's few things that is more unsafe than that.
It certainly does sound that as progress happens, that there is, you know, that trade-off. On the one hand, you are seeing, maybe safer forms of transacting on that end. But at the same time, you do have, you know, criminals also now changing how they operate. And there was a study done recently by Accenture, and they actually estimated that about 2.2 billion rand is lost each year through fraudulent activities carried out via the internet. And with that in mind, I'd like for us to sort of switch to sort of a broader view of the economy going forward. Because when we've traditionally framed the advantages of the digital economy, I'm not sure if enough has been said about what the risks are. And, you know, an event like this sort of highlights that point. Could you talk to us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, with COVID-19 also, we've seen a significant increase in, for example, online purchases, because they were allowed. So we've seen a 150% growth in online purchases on our customer base, you know, coming out of lockdown 4 into 3 as well. And in many ways, I mean, customers can be pretty well protected in terms of moving towards a more digital economy if they're participating in it right. So, you know, if customers are using their banking relationship right, if they're using the app for payments or credit cards, etc., you know, their risk is relatively low. I think on the business side, there is still quite a bit of things to do in terms of education. For example, EFTs, you know, is something that where people will intercept emails and they will send you an invoice that pretends to be from someone else. And if you're just paying that that invoice and typing in that account number, it could actually go to the wrong party. So in this increasing amount of, you know, digitization of the economy and people not seeing other people face to face and making payments to people they've never seen, or making payments based on emails that they're receiving without validating the account numbers, there is still a lot of education that needs to take place to make sure that one keeps it you know, as safe as possible.
And one of the other things is that a bank like FNB has a presence in more than one country. I'm not sure whether you could maybe expand on whether, you know, some of these trends are also being seen in some of our neighboring countries, or does the risk of cyber attacks speak to the fact that South Africa does have a high level of banking as compared to some of its neighbors?
I think that's always great. I think we often, based on the reported statistics, we think that, you know, South Africa is an epicenter of crime. If I can say clearly, you will know from the cash industry, cash in transit, heists, and those kind of things, then clearly from a physical crime perspective, you know, South Africa would rate quite high in terms of the crime stakes. From a digital crime perspective, and, you know, we measure specifically, for example, what happens on card fraud numbers and on online fraud numbers. On those, South Africa actually rates very, very well. And like I mentioned, for example, in the US, card or plastic fraud is significantly higher than what it is in South Africa, just because of the rollout of chip and PIN. So EMV cards, we've had that, you know, for many, many years, whereas the US didn't make the move until more recently. If I talk a bit more about the rest of our businesses across the African continent, so our businesses in Africa, there, generally, the levels of crime are substantially lower than we have in South Africa in terms of, for example, card fraud or even physical crime in terms of cash. But certainly, fraud is still a major factor to consider there as well. So if you are lending money in African continent, etc., you have to be quite careful in terms of diligence with customers. So I would say it's not exactly like it is here, but certainly, you know, it is something that one has to be careful about, you know, across the continent.
And then as we come to the end of the discussion, one of the things that you did raise at the start was the fact that there were two points that I picked up when you were talking. The first one was when you said the information that was perhaps extracted from this attack was not necessarily banking information, and it might not necessarily result in actual crimes being committed. But that then led to the second point where you said, more than anything else, it might lead more to reputational damage than anything else. How do companies, businesses, governments, organizations, I guess, protect themselves from that? Because it seems that's a harder one to do, because that's more a matter of perception than necessarily, you know, hard activities or crimes on the ground.
Madhua, I think that's right. I mean, the reputational impact you would have seen from in the US, you know, from what happened with players like Facebook, etc., it can be extremely damaging. So I think, you know, firms and especially banks like FirstRand or FNB, you know, we are very aware of the reputational damage that any kind of incident can happen. I think on this one as well, we said, look, it's important for us to at least speak out about it, because at the same time, we can give some reassurance that customers don't have to panic. We think that we've got a handle on this one. And if you know, as long as customers are careful, they can be protected. So I think it's always a balance between obviously communicating and being transparent about what is happening. But at the same time, one also doesn't want to, you know, create fear. when actually the banking system is safe. And while, you know, fraud and cybercrime certainly will happen, at least in this case, you know, we do think that this situation is being managed.
It certainly does sound like, that transparency might be the best way forward, you know, at least letting your customers know what's actually going on the ground and actually have that relationship. On the last point, Dr. Christoph, what are you excited about when it comes to all of the different trends and developments that have come about as a result of COVID-19? We've spoken a lot about adoption, and for the most part, this conversation has been the result of a negative event. But are there any things that you have actually seen in the last couple of months in the banking space that you are actually positive about to say, okay, fine, this, it might have been a bad time, but this has been, you know, sort of good in taking us forward?
They were interesting questions, because actually I was very involved in the Business for South Africa process during the entire pandemic. So we even built epidemiological models to predict, you know, what would happen with the spread of the disease. As much as, I guess, initially, you know, everybody was quite in shock about the potential for the disease from a humanitarian and from a loss of life perspective, I think even though South Africa had very high infection rates, we've actually come out relatively well from a mortality point of view. I think secondly, on business, while the lockdown had a massive effect on business, as soon as the categories were reopened, we did see businesses, you know, opening up and customers flocking back and spending again. So we are quite optimistic about the fact that this, you know, there is a rebound in customer incomes, there's a rebound in customer activity. And some of the aspects that I mentioned, like the growth of the digital economy in this space, is actually quite important for South Africa to be competitive, you know, versus the US and China, which seem to dominate the big tech space. It's quite important for South African players to step up and to provide, you know, compelling digital services for South Africa to remain competitive, and not, you know, at the end just be delivered to buying all our goods and be dependent on, you know, US and Chinese companies basically playing an intermediary role in the economy for us.
So that was us with Dr. Christoph Nivaut, who is an FNB executive, giving us some insight into the economics news of the week, which were highly impacted by the Experian cyber attack, which happened the other day, affecting the personal information of as many as 24 million South Africans and about 800,000 businesses. He was just giving us some insight into what actually happened and clarifying the types of data that actually may have been at risk, and also just giving us some insights into what they have been doing to educate their customers and how they have been communicating with their customers about the crisis going forward. One of the big things that he is saying is that, you know, reputational damage is one of the big things. For the most part, he is positive about moving businesses onto digital platforms because it reduces the amount of risk of certain types of crimes with cash or with check fraud, for example. But he's just saying that when an attack like this does happen, reputational damage is one of the biggest risks, as we have seen with Facebook around some of their, you know, privacy and also cybersecurity allegations that have been leveled against them. And he's a big advocate of being transparent with customers and just letting them know what's going on.
This is Mudiwa's Take.
Quite an important conversations to be having with one of the biggest banks in the country, that was FNB. And it would, you know, I'd be keen to also chat with the team at Standard Bank just to understand what they're doing to sort of remedy some of these things, or to at least ease the anxieties around consumers that might feel vulnerable during this time. An important conversation, because as we move more and more business online, some of these crimes are going to happen more and more. And in some cases, they might become even more brazen. I like the fact that Dr. Christoph talks about the cash in transit heists, which are a factor in South Africa, but not so much in other countries. So from that point of view, and just highlighting the fact that digital crime hasn't been that big of an issue in other African countries. But the fact that you have criminals that had gotten to the extent that they were willing to do cash in transit heists as brazen, you know, using bombs, guns, as they were, especially in the last maybe like 2-3 years, when there was that long spate of them, it also then speaks to the fact that we might see an escalation in the type of cyber attacks that we see. Because right now we're talking about the Experian cyber attack that's affecting the financial services sector. But just last week, we had Momentum that had its own cybersecurity breach. And we're likely going to be seeing more and more of these, because the new Protection of Personal Information Act, or POPI, actually mandates companies that if there is a breach, they need to make these things public. And since it came into effect on the 1st of July, we're likely going to be seeing more companies having to tell us about what happens. Because I think up until this point, the attacks have been there, but because there was no duty to communicate some of these things, we never heard about it. So those are the two things that in future we might see more of. Firstly, just a greater awareness of cyber attacks because the law mandates it. And two, an escalation, you know, because let's be real, you know, criminals do exist, and people will be testing the boundaries, trying to see how far they can go, how much they can get. And if, as the example I used earlier on, if people can get to the extent of using bombs, etc., Italian Job, Ocean's 11, you know, vibes in terms of some of the bank robberies that we've seen over the years, then who's to say that people won't have the brazenness to try and attempt, you know, such daring attacks online and actually, you know, take out industries. So these are all the dangers that we all need to be aware of. But on the whole, as a technology enthusiast, geek lover, I think technology is a good thing, and in a lot of cases it has been able to keep us safer. But in all the progress that it does provide, we all just need to be careful and make sure that we go about our business in a safe and secure manner. So that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcasts on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab. On Twitter, we're #BDSpotlight. And you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your pods casted. Thank you to our amazing team. Our producer is Paige Muller, together with Didi Mashamaite. My name is Mdiwa Gabaza, and this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a Multimedia Live production. So for myself and the rest of the team, it is good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.